welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 20th of July 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAlbion.com. Well, it's the start of another glorious week here at Radio Albion, and we do have our co-host, Mr. Max Musson from Western Spring, here with us today. Max, good afternoon. How are you doing?
Good afternoon. I'm absolutely fine. In fact, very well indeed. That's probably the best way of describing it. We've had a glorious weekend with lots and lots of sunny weather. And I've been out and about doing this and that. And I think that one of the best things really is that we're slowly emerging now from the lockdown situation that we've had with COVID-19, and so the nation is kind of coming back to life, and let's hope that it's a very vigorous life that it returns to in the future.
It certainly needs to, doesn't it? They're offering, I think they're offering some money off if people go out for a meal, up to £10 off, I think. They're offering some VAT off as well, I think, in hotels and pubs. It's still a little bit slow, though, isn't it? They said this week that from August, 30 people can meet up, which, you know, that's really not that good. We need more people to be meeting up than that. They'll probably make another announcement in August, and they'll probably say 200 or 500 people can meet up from September. But you would think that they would do this more quickly. They did in Germany. They did speed it up in Germany, but then we can look at America, where I think they went too fast. And they're now getting a big increase, and they're having to shut down Florida, and they're having to shut down Texas again. And I think they did it too fast there. But I do think we could do with speeding it up here. But as well as that, we've had this big scandal with the way that they have been recording the figures that has come out this week. And there's been a lot of talk about how there have been inflated statistics. And I was more of the opinion that they'd actually been squashing the statistics, because they weren't originally including all the people that were dying in the old people's homes, but it appears they have now been including them. But besides that, they've actually been putting down anybody that tested positive who then went on to die. They could have died of a car accident, it could have been months later and they just died of natural causes, and they've all been put down as COVID 19 statistics. I've got a quote here which pretty much explains it all. Has Public Health England been exaggerating the COVID-19 daily death statistics? It appears that Public Health England compiles out-of-hospital deaths by searching the NHS database for whether that person has ever tested positive. It then apparently fails to consider how long ago that person tested positive or their actual cause of death. By this PHE definition, no one with COVID in England is allowed to ever recover from their illness, says Professor Yoon K. Loke and Carl Hennigan, who discovered the statistical flaw. And the government have now actually stopped publishing the daily death statistics for England because of this. Apparently in Wales and Scotland, they haven't been doing this, but they've been doing this in England, which means that the statistics have been massively inflated. And I think on top of that, they keep saying so many people have contracted the disease, but they've massively increased the testing as well. So we've got lots of people that are being tested, lots more people now that are being tested, and they're all test, you know, if they test positive for it, the numbers go up, but the actual numbers of deaths don't seem to be going up. And all those people that are now tested positive, if this hadn't been discovered and they died within the next 6 months, they would be put down as COVID-19 deaths. I mean, this is really serious that they've been caught out doing this. I don't like to think that they've been doing it deliberately, but they could have been doing it deliberately. I mean, that they've got to justify this this destruction of the economy that they've been going on. What do you make of this, Max?
Well, it is a very alarming thing to discover, and because it does suggest that somebody in government is attempting to manipulate the figures to make the death statistics from COVID-19 look worse than they actually are. I mean, there are certain medical sources that claim that COVID-19 isn't actually anything particularly special, and that it is very similar to other forms of influenza that have been going around, other forms of common cold, because I think I've reported before that there are 200 different viruses that are coronaviruses. I think so there's something like about 50 different coronaviruses. There's loads of rhinoviruses, and there are several different kinds of influenza virus, all of which behave in a very similar way, all of which cause very similar symptoms, and all of which can be fatal if you get a particularly big viral dose right at the very beginning. And I think what's happened is that the government have massively overreacted with the advent of the spread of the virus, and they've gone into lockdown, and lockdown is a process which you could almost describe as being the deliberate killing of the economy, because I've argued this before as well, that an economy is rather like a tree, and the economic activity within within the economy, it could be regarded as being comparable to the process of photosynthesis, through which the plant gains energy and grows. And if you try to prevent a tree from photosynthesizing, and you manage to prevent it from photosynthesizing for 4 months, when you then allow it to photosynthesize again, the tree may actually still recover from having been kept dormant for that 4 month period, but the tree will not be the tree that it was when the photosynthesis was stopped. And it's the same with the economy. If you stop economic activity for 4 months, then when you try to then regenerate and restart the economy isn't the same economy it was 4 months previously. It's a damaged economy, in the same way a tree that's been prevented from photosynthesizing would be a damaged tree. And when you consider the amount of money that's been borrowed for all of these various furlough projects, etc., and you can argue the case for these for all these economic interventions and the necessity to have them if it's necessary to shut the economy down, but the actual decision to shut the economy down was, in my view, a flawed decision, and that it will actually eventually be the undoing of the Conservative Party. I think that unless he's very, very careful, Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak are going to be remembered as the two men who engineered the largest recession that this country will have seen for over 100 years. Because the amount of money that's been borrowed in order to inject into the economy to keep us in a situation of economic inactivity for 4 months, or large proportion of the British population in a state of economic inactivity for 4 months. The amount of money that's been borrowed has massively increased our national debt, and that will have a tremendous impact. And so lots of firms that have been furloughing their staff are now in a situation where when the furloughing ends, they're going to make those staff redundant. And so the likelihood is that we'll, as we go into this autumn, that we will have the highest unemployment for many, many years. We will have certainly the highest level of public debt for many, many years. The debt repayments will be crippling as far as the government is concerned. There will be tremendous pressure on the government and on Rishi Sunak to increase taxes in order for us to be able to afford the debt repayments. Or the other option that the government would have would be to indulge in quantitative easing and to print loads of money in place of borrowing money. But if you just print loads of money, then of course that causes inflation, and so it looks like we're going to be heading into a very economically rocky period. And I think that the public are slowly coming to realize that COVID-19 isn't the Black Death. It can be very nasty if you get a big viral load, and we've seen the effect that it has had on individual people. But by and large, COVID-19, vast swathes of this country are like virtually untouched by COVID-19 in terms of there being any sort of serious numbers of deaths. And so naturally, the tendency for the government is going to be to try and pass on the blame for damaging the economy in the way that it's been damaged, and to place the blame for that on the shoulders of the COVID virus, rather than saying, oh, actually, we got it wrong and the virus isn't anything like as bad as we thought it was going to be. And accepting the blame themselves, which would then be the end of their political careers. And so what we've got is this situation as we're going into the sort of second half of the summer now, where people are going to have to wear the face masks going into shops. They're increasing the amount of face mask wearing, even at a time when there is no medical evidence to show that wearing a face mask actually does any real good or not. And you know, there are some people that argue that wearing a face mask is actually more likely to cause you to, in certain circumstances, would be more likely to cause you to contract the virus than if you weren't wearing one. And but as I say, we're in a situation now where I think the government are just trying to distract everybody's attention away from the fact that they've embarked upon a round of public spending, and with the lockdown, they've created the conditions that are going to lead to a very severe recession.
I think it's going to affect both Labour and Conservatives, because both of them have wanted this lockdown, and the Labour Party have been wanting an even stricter lockdown, and they haven't wanted the economy to open up at all. I think this could be the end of Labour and Conservative. I think if there is another party that is there when we next have an election, I think that this could be the chance that we get to break the two-party stranglehold on the country, just to think of something positive there. But what do you think of the idea that this was deliberately done because the economy had got into such a bad state with all the debt, with America owes, you know, trillions in debt. There was just so much debt that has built up over the years that they needed something to happen, because there was going to be a big crash and like there was the last time when they had to bail the banks out. I've heard that the economies of the world, or the economies of the West in particular, were heading for something really bad to happen, and that what they've done is used COVID-19 as the excuse. They've used this as the excuse, and they said, oh, this is what's crashed the economy, and it has crashed the economy, but it's basically been a cover-up for what would have happened if we hadn't had this COVID-19. And what they've actually done is they've bailed out the big businesses while wiping out the smaller businesses. So there'll be a big takeover, a corporate takeover of everything. And you won't have any smaller shops. You won't have a middle class anymore, but you will still have the great big Walmarts, the great big Tescos, and these big stores and these big banks at the end of it. What do you make of that theory, Max?
I think it's very difficult to actually pinpoint a reason why what's been done has been done. I think that an outcome and the way to investigate this is to look to see who's benefited. And I think that you've put your finger on one possibility, which is that bigger businesses have been able to benefit or haven't suffered as badly as a result of the lockdown as small and medium-sized businesses. And so therefore it is concentrating more of the wealth of the world into fewer hands. And I would think that kind of an answer is probably going to be the one that will eventually emerge, because I was speaking to an accountant just a few days ago, and was asking who benefits from what's been going on. Is there anybody that is actually benefiting? And the answer that I got there was that nobody appears to be benefiting, apart from the fact that that larger businesses have been damaged less than small and medium-sized businesses. And in fact, some large businesses have, when banks have made large credit facilities available to them. Effectively, what a lot of the banks have done is they've turned around to large businesses and said, right, you know, we'll give you a massive overdraft to get you through all this. With certain businesses, they've taken advantage of those massive overdrafts and borrowed all the money, and have then stopped paying all of their suppliers and creditors, etc. And have been then reluctant to pay their creditors and their suppliers in the hope that these suppliers will go bust and that the debt that was owed to them will die with the demise of their smaller companies, and at the end of it the large company will be left in a situation where they are cash rich because they've borrowed this massive amount of overdraft. They'll have to obviously pay it back at some point, but the terms on which these facilities have been made available to large firms have been very generous.
This is a problem with the capitalist system, isn't it? It's all out for yourself. Make as much profit as you can from everybody else because they're trying to make as much profit as they can from you. And if somebody is in a bad way, they want to take advantage of that. They don't want to help that person out. They want to take advantage of that because it means that they're going to make more for themselves. It's the opposite of the nationalist way, where you're doing what is best for the nation, and that guides everything. What is best for the nation? Well, you need smaller businesses, you need larger businesses as well, and you need the government to help them out. I mean, if you look at what's going on in China, China's economy has bounced back. Their GDP has exceeded all expectations, and this is because they have a nationalist economy. The government helps out the businesses. This is why the rest of the world, or America, is trying to put sanctions on them and trade embargoes. This is why Britain accuses them of unfair trading practices. It's because they've got nationalist trading practices, and the nationalist trading practices are showing that is the way countries need to be. And it means that they can bounce back from this, and we can't, because of the very thing that you're just talking about there, Max. But, you know, there's no loyalty to these smaller businesses. It's the capitalist model. Do you see what I mean? I think China's doing really well. I don't know if you've if you've looked into it, how they're bouncing back, but their GDP has gone up. I was talking about it last week with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. He follows what's going on in China very, very, very closely. He says that they are the equivalent of a national socialist country. They have socialism, but it's with a distinctly Chinese form of socialism, and it's all about raising up the Chinese people. And they don't have multicultural. It's not multicultural at all. They still have a very, very strong sense of who they are and sense of identity, which we don't have here in Britain, which I think will come back. I think the rebound to this, as I say, I think we, you know, it could be the end of the Conservatives and Labour, and I think there will be room for a nationalist party to rise in the next few years when we next get another election. I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Max, before we move on to the next.
What I would say is that the likelihood is that lots of people are going to be made unemployed. That lots of people who've been slaving to start their own small businesses or even medium-sized businesses are going to see those businesses fail and are going to go bust. If that's not enough to wake the nation up to the fact that something really seriously different needs to happen, then I don't know what will. And hopefully it will be enough to make people wake up, and hopefully it will be enough to make a very significant number of people start to vote for nationalist political parties, and that hopefully within the foreseeable future we will have a government that puts the people first instead of a government that puts profit first.
Well, while all this has been going on, you would have thought the government would be thinking, well, how can we get business going again? We need to stimulate the economy. We need to get people spending money. But no, they're far more interested in Shamima Begum, the jihadi terrorist girl that went off to marry a jihadi terrorist and helped sew suicide vests and was a part of the morality police in the Islamic State, who had her citizenship stripped from her because she did have dual citizenship. She did have citizenship with Bangladesh. Well, she's appealed the fact that she had her citizenship stripped from her. And now the courts in Britain have decided that she has to come back to Britain to appeal this. Never mind the fact that at the moment the courts are operating through the internet and people are doing the court proceedings online. There's no need for her to actually come back to Britain. And on top of that, as many as 150 Islamist terrorists could attempt to return to the UK to overturn decisions that stripped them of their British citizenship after the Court of Appeal ruling on jihadi teen bride Jemima Begum. On Thursday, the court ruled that 20-year-old Miss Begum, who left the UK aged 15 to marry an Islamic State fighter in Syria, can return to the UK to challenge the government decision to remove her British citizenship. And what I want to know is, why hasn't she gone to Holland with her husband? She's married her husband. Surely she has the same citizenship as her husband now. Isn't he responsible for her? And the excuses that are being made for this is, she left Britain when she was just 15. She was groomed. She didn't know what she was doing. And then on the other hand, we've got Greta Thunberg there, who is advising political leaders on what they should do about the climate. They all look up to her as if she's an expert. She's the same age. So you can't have Greta Thunberg is a responsible adult on the one hand, and yet Jemima Begum at 15, she was groomed. She was just an innocent. She was just a poor child. She's 20 years old now. She should be made to stay there in Syria. She went over there. She became a citizen of the Islamic State. The Islamic State of Syria fell apart, and you now have the original Syrian state there. She should be a citizen of Syria. That's where she went to. And the fact that she's arguing this, there's no way she should have to come. She should be able to come back to Britain to argue the point here. And at the moment, we've got a lot of people in there. In the leftist media that are cheering this on. Apparently we've got Keir Starmer. He supported this. Apparently he spearheaded this. He was the main man behind this. This comes on top of him taking a knee to the Black Lives Matter terrorists, and it comes after him trying to put a stop to Brexit. I mean, this Keir Starmer, I think, he's a real menace. I mean, he hates the British people. He's just volunteered for diversity training as well. What do you make of this decision that Jemima Begum can now come back to Britain to argue her case in the courts, Max?
Well, it obviously is a terrible decision. I think that as far as the courts in this country are concerned, there needs to be somebody needs to take a very serious look at the background of the judges that sit on the and decide on these sort of cases, because they've obviously got a political bias, in my view, and that needs to be corrected. We've had the decision by the courts over Brexit. I can't think quite what the actual issue was, but there was the
decisions. Proroguing of Parliament, wasn't it? Boris Johnson wanted to prorogue Parliament.
That's right, the proroguing of Parliament. And so that there was that decision which was by the courts, and that should have alerted the government to the fact that there are people in our legal system who seem to be making decisions that are contrary to the interests of the British nation. And again, I think this again is a decision which is contrary to the interests of the British nation. It's difficult to imagine how anybody can feel that any good is going to come of this, because as far as Miss Begum is concerned, she has been living for 5 years in Syria. She went out there to fight for Islamic State, a state that existed at the time, which was a rogue outlaw state that had declared war on this country, that was attempting to shoot and kill British soldiers that were trying to keep the peace in Syria, and who were in fact inspiring Islamic terrorists in this country to commit terrorist attacks here in the UK and in other Western countries around the world. So why anybody would want her to come back to this country? What possible good could her coming back to this country do for us as a nation? And that's what we've got to consider, not what's best for her, but what's best for us, the nation. And the court should serve the interests of the nation and not serve the interests of an individual. And this is where I think that the courts are going wrong, particularly in this case. I'm thinking, what's the best thing for Miss Begum? And the best thing for her would be for her to be able to become a British citizen. Why they would think that, why they would think that would be any good for us, and why they would think that, we ought to have any concern for her at all, escapes me completely.
Yeah, they're looking at her as the victim instead of us being the victim. She was part of this group that declared war against our people. They were fighting against our soldiers, fighting against people in Syria, doing these horrific things, beheading Christians, crucifying Christians. She was part of this group, and they're looking at her as if she's the victim. And on top of that, as it says here, that there are another 150 Islamist terrorists who will now also be able to appeal this decision and be able to ask whether they can come back to Britain to argue their case. And on top of that, she's getting legal aid for this. She's actually getting legal aid. It's the British taxpayers that are funding her to argue this case. It's just absolutely ludicrous. And I do think it's another, it's another black mark against Keir Starmer, because he is being shown as being very supportive of this, and he says he thinks it's correct for her to come back, and I think he is totally out of touch with the general mood in Britain. I mean, maybe you could say that some of the Muslims might support her coming back, but Muslims don't make up that much of a percentage of the population in Britain. Probably only about 5%, something like that. I would say 90% of Britain would not want this woman to be coming back here, and are thinking, what on earth is going on here that the courts of appeal have allowed this? Because the government stripped her citizenship. Once again, you've got the courts going against the government, the same as in America when Donald Trump tries to do anything. You've got these judges over there that say, oh, no, we're going to reinterpret the Constitution to say that you can't do that. And we had the same here, as you pointed out, Max, with the Supreme Court, which was modelled on the American one that Tony Blair brought in, that were very political and decided to say that proroguing Parliament was illegal, something which had been done countless times over the last 100 years, and always has a secondary motive behind actually doing it. And we saw then, as you pointed out, that they were opposed to what the government is actually doing. And now we've got this again. We need to have an inquiry into these judges. As you say, I think that's what needs to happen, because they shouldn't be politically minded. They should be completely neutral. And time and time again, they are showing that they are not neutral at all. It's like the way that the left have infiltrated all the universities. They've infiltrated all the top posts in all the civil service, and they've infiltrated the courts as well. And unless somebody does anything about it, you know, it's just going to continue with these anti-white decisions that they make.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there with regard to the sort of education system. Extreme left wingers have infiltrated the education system in this country to the point now where the universities are effectively training grounds, that brainwashing establishments, where anybody that goes there comes out brainwashed, a sort of brainwashed liberal lefty. I say not everybody, because there are some exceptions, but a disproportionately large number of people do come out that way. And I think that as far as the legal profession is concerned, the legal profession now is composed of lots of people who went to university in the 70s and the 80s, and who were subjected to that kind of left-wing propagandizing all the way through their training period. And they've come out and they've been making decisions that are sympathetic to left-wing causes at every step and turn through their careers, and something needs to be done. The government need to think about redressing the balance so that we get some people who will apply greater common sense effectively, and as you say, who will be politically unbiased. That's going to be require a virtual revolution in the courts in this country and throughout the legal system. But it's something that urgently needs to be done, because we can't go on with decision after decision after decision, you know, the stupid decisions that are being made, not just even through the courts, but in every public institution now there are stupid decisions being made, and decisions that enrage people and that alienate people. And we we're fast developing a situation where, as far as the public are concerned, the public have got very little respect left now for politicians, got very little respect left now for people who are leading our police forces, very little respect now for people who are in positions of influence in the courts. The outcome is going to be disastrous if somebody doesn't step in and do something to rectify the imbalance.
Well, that's where it all begins, isn't it? It all begins with the education. I mean, even before university, it begins in the schools, and they don't hear a plurality of views. All this Black Lives Matter stuff is being taught to children in schools with no questioning of it, as if everything that they are saying is you know, it's the unvarnished truth, and that they're not pointing out the alternative voices. There was a program on the BBC about the Edward Colston statue being pulled down, and it was just relentless propaganda. There was no alternative voice. There was nobody speaking up for Colston, nobody speaking up for the British Empire, nobody speaking up for the fact that we got rid of slavery. It was just relentless anti-whiteness, and that is what is being taught in the schools. But again, there may be a glimmer of hope where the children haven't actually gone back to school and where they have been homeschooled for the last 3 months. There are a lot of people that have enjoyed doing that, and they've enjoyed teaching their children. And I think we might see an increase in homeschool children that maybe have a bit more balanced view. And then when they get to university and they start hearing all this anti-white filth, basically, that they're being taught, maybe it won't affect them so much, and maybe they'll be brave enough to challenge it. But we'll have to just wait and see. Shall we talk about something positive, Max? Shall we talk about Sir Francis Galton?
Yes, let's talk about him.
Let's get into Sir Francis Galton, our greatest Briton for the week. Last week we briefly talked about him being a polymath and the many disciplines he excelled in, alongside some of his pioneering work, including inventing weather forecasts and fingerprinting, as well as being the father of eugenics, which we also discussed alongside some debate on medicine being dysgenic. We also talked about the difference between positive and negative eugenics, and Max explained how the value of a child born to labourer parents can be calculated against the value to the nation of a child born to artisan or intellectual genius parents, and how if the child of either could be purchased, the value of the second would be infinitely more than the value of the first, although the first is still essential for a functioning society. So you can put a numerical value on the people that actually make up society. And obviously you want to have the best people in your society, which is what eugenics is. And today we have this dysgenic society that rewards and encourages those who are least likely to excel, to breed, and those who are most likely to excel, the bright people, they're encouraged not to breed at all. I mean, so many bright women now are encouraged to go out and have a career and not have children, for a start. Do you want to add anything to that? Anything else that you remember from last week that you wanted to bring up there, Max, before we get into his travels?
There was the issue that I mentioned with regard to him recognizing that human inequality, and I think that's one of the things that that both in our society and other societies in Western countries around the world, we've got to recognise that human individuals are unequal in terms of the abilities that they've got, and the guiding spirit within our country has got to be one in which not only do we recognise that, but the systems that we operate and the culture that we create embodies that kind of thing as well. And one of the things that Galton went on to say was that the importance of eugenics was such that eugenics could almost become should almost be regarded as a religion, and that our religion should incorporate eugenic principles, so that I'm just looking for my should incorporate eugenic principles so that it becomes a permanent facet of our society. If I just read you some of some extracts from the book that I've got, Essays in Eugenics. It says here that eugenics strengthens the sense of social duty in so many important particulars that the conclusions derived from its study ought to find a welcome home in every tolerant religion. It promotes a far-sighted philanthropy, the acceptance of parentage as a serious responsibility, and a higher conception of patriotism. The creed of eugenics is founded upon the idea of evolution, not on a passive form of it, but on one that can, to some extent, direct its own course. And so this is an important element, that that we are the product of human evolution, but as far as mankind is concerned, we have now achieved a level of technological ability such that we can insulate ourselves from the natural forces that have guided the evolution of our species over the last several 100,000 years, and that if that evolution isn't to either come to an end or to take some disastrous turn, then we need to accept responsibility for guiding our own evolution, and the guiding of our own evolution is an aspect of eugenics. And he says, furthermore, evolution is in any case a grand phantasmagoria, but it assumes an infinitely more interesting aspect under the knowledge that the intelligent action of the human will is in some small measure capable of guiding its course.
That fits in with the survival of the fittest, isn't it? You know, you want the survival of the fittest, because then you haven't got people that are sick and ill and not getting the most out of life. You want people that are not going to be ill, that are going to have the right amount of testosterone, that are going to have good eyesight, that are going to have a high IQ, that are capable of improving their surroundings, rather than people who rely upon other people to look after them. We want more people that are capable of looking after others, not people that need looking after. I think that's what it really boils down to. Because, as you say, we've become insulated from nature now, and we've got all this this medicine which increases life and keeps people alive who before would have died while they were infants, and that gives them a chance to reproduce, and then we get more of them, and a lot of them would get these dysgenic ideas, these anti-white ideas, these liberal ideas. You know, there's studies that have been done that show that the people that come out with these left-wing ideas, you know, they are objectively ugly, and they're objectively ugly because they have all these mutant genes. They have all these genes which shouldn't be there, which wouldn't have made their way to adulthood 100 years ago. So we've got this dysgenic society. Sorry, Max, I interrupted you there. Did you want to add something else?
Well, the final passage of the book I've highlighted here is that continued studies will be required for some time to come, and the pace must not be hurried. When the desired fullness of information shall have been acquired, then will be the fit moment to proclaim a jihad, or holy war, against customs and prejudices that impair the physical and moral qualities of our race, which sort of plants Galton very firmly in a very sort of militant form of eugenic advocacy, I think.
Well, you brought up religion there, and it should be a part of religion. And, you know, if you look at the Christian religion, it tells you that man was made in the image of God. And if you have a man that's genetically deformed, I mean, that's a mockery of God. And that person is not going to lead the fullest of lives that he could live. I mean, so even religiously, you could go along with this. You could say that, you know, that man was created perfect, and that is the way that he should be. And we should be striving for perfection, and we should be doing all we can to prevent deformities and people that aren't going to live up to the fullest of expectations. They're not going to lead the best lives. We should be trying to prevent them from being born. If they are born, I'm not saying, you know, they should be badly treated, but we should be we shouldn't be encouraging their birth. Because it just means that gradually, all the superior excellenceness becomes swamped in mediocrity, and you know this plays in with immigration as well, which you know, because he understood the differences between the races. But we'll get more into his eugenics later on, before he actually got to discovering that and giving it the name eugenics, he'd actually made quite a few other achievements. Because, as we say, he's a polymath and he excelled in many of these disciplines. And the first thing that he actually did was went travelling, and that was really where he made his name. He took up medicine and mathematical studies at first, but when his father died, he terminated his studies. And as he was financially cared for, because he came from a good home, obviously he had wealthy parents, wealthy ancestors, because they had a high IQ, which gets passed on down through the generations. So he was wealthy enough to be able to do whatever he wanted, basically. So he decided to do some traveling. And he went through Eastern Europe to Constantinople, and then along the Nile from Egypt to the Sudan, and along the Jordan to Beirut and Damascus. And in 1850, he joined the Royal Geographical Society, and over the next 2 years mounted a long and difficult expedition into the then little known Southwest Africa, which is now called Namibia, which became the basis for his book, Narrative of an Explorer in Southwest Africa. And after winning 2 medals for his survey of Africa, he then wrote the bestseller, The Art of Travel, a handbook of practical advice for the Victorian on the move, which went through many editions and is still in print. I would like to see that. I'm quite jealous of these Victorians that were able to go to these places, you know, at the height of the British Empire, and still feel as if they were discovering new things, and they were setting a good example. And this, you know, this confirms what we said in the last episode about him obviously being very physically fit, as well as being extremely bright, which would go along with this idea of, if you've got good genes, then you're going to be bright and you're going to have good ideas. And it's reflected in the physicality, of the person. I'm not sure, was the Ottoman Empire still going at this time? He's going along the Jordan to Beirut and Damascus. Was that a part of the Ottoman Empire, or was it part of the British Empire at that time?
I don't think it would have been part of the British Empire. I think it's more likely to be part of the Ottoman Empire or perhaps some other configuration of Arab states. I don't think that we occupied. Oh, I think we occupied the Middle East during the First World War, and so obviously that is about 70 years later, isn't it? It was 70 years later than the 1850 when he conducted his expedition.
So he's in enemy territory as well. He's not travelling in the British Empire here. He's travelling within the Ottoman Empire. And also you can see that while he was in Africa, he must have had a lot of experience with the natives, which must have taught him a lot as well.
Yes.
Well, after that, we get to his middle years. And since he was a polymath, he made many contributions to many different fields of science, including meteorology, the anticyclone and the first popular weather maps, statistics, which was regression and correlation, psychology, synesthesia. That's an interesting one. That's when you hear colours or you taste sounds. It's the blending of
sensory perception.
Sensory perception, yeah. But blending of the senses. Biology, the nature and mechanism of heredity, the fact that we inherit so much of ourselves, we inherit from our parents and from our ancestors. And criminology, fingerprints. If it wasn't for him, then we wouldn't have the technology and the ability to solve crimes by people's fingerprints. And much of this was influenced by his penchant for counting and measuring, because he would look at these statistics, he'd make all these charts up, and then he would work out what the average was and look at what you could predict from looking at these statistics. And he was one of the first people to do that. He prepared the first weather map, published in the Times on the 1st of April 1875, showing the weather from the previous day, which is now a standard feature in newspapers worldwide. He became very active in the British Association for the Advancement of Science, presenting many papers on a wide variety of topics at its meetings from 1858 to 1899. He was the General Secretary from 63 to 67, president of the geographical section in 67 and 72, and president of the anthropological section in 77 and 85. So he's obviously very interested in anthropology and the study of different races, different tribes, and the different cultures that they have. And he was actually active on the Council of the Royal Geographical Society for over 40 years in various committees of the Royal Society and on the Meteorological Council. And in 1888, he established a lab in the science galleries of the South Kensington Museum. And in Galton's lab, participants could be measured to gain knowledge of their strengths and weaknesses. And Galton then used this data for his own research. And he would typically charge people a small fee for his services. So I guess he wouldn't just physically measure them. He would measure their intelligence. And this is before we had IQ tests. And he would ask these questions about people's personality and then give them these predictions. And at the same time, save all that data up so that he could then use it to find out in more general about people and about different races, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that you mentioned in that was his penchant for measuring things. And there's a saying in the world of business that you can't manage what you can't measure. And so that's why businesses employ lots of accountants to keep track of the number of business transactions and the frequency of this and the frequency of that, so that they can manage the way in which their business grows and can make their business grow by managing it properly. And so that fits in very, very well with this approach that Galton had of measuring things and analyzing the data to identify patterns, so that he could then come forward with his theories as to how we should manage the growth and reproduction of our population to the best advantage.
Yeah, he wasn't very impressed with superstition, was he? You think, you know, in the past, people would try to make predictions, you know, they would look at entrails, or, you know, you get your palms red or whatever. And he came up with the idea of, no, we'll measure as much as we can, and then we'll collate all the measurements that we have, and then we'll use that to try and predict what's going to happen in the future. As you say, that this is done all the time now to try and predict what the markets are going to do. Well, we mentioned before that he was related to Charles Darwin. I think it was his cousin. And Charles Darwin published The Origin of the Species in 1859. And Galton found the first chapter on variation under domestication, which concerned animal breeding, to be of particular importance. And of course, this is about the improvements that you make in say, horses, or improvements that farmers make in their stock that they have of cows, and they get the best stallion or the best bull, and they continue to breed the best animals that they possibly can. It's the same with horticulture. You know, the growers try to grow the best flowers and the best plants that they can. So he saw this and he understood this, and he thought, well, why aren't we doing this with humans? So he then devoted much of the rest of his life to exploring all the variations that could be found in human populations and what their implications were, which is something that Darwin had only hinted at. And in doing so, he established a research program which embraced multiple aspects of human variation, from mental characteristics to height, from facial images to fingerprint patterns. This required inventing novel measures of traits, devising a large-scale collection of data using those measures, and in the end, the discovery of new statistical techniques for describing and understanding the data. And I bet there's a hell of a lot of politically incorrect conclusions that he reached from this. I bet they discovered that, obviously they would have discovered that criminality passed down through the family, but they also probably would have discovered that there were certain physical measurements that you could make of people that could predict whether they were likely to be criminal. I know about 100 years ago, they said that there was a particular criminal type that you could see just from looking at people. I know Dr. Edward Dutton brought out a book last year, how you can judge people by what they look like, because you can judge people by what they look like. And this is what he was doing, basically. I mean, it's fascinating stuff here.
Yeah, absolutely. The importance of Sir Francis Galton is that he has touched the everyday lives of virtually everybody in this country, you know, because a lot of people in academia nowadays will denigrate Galton on the basis that he was a eugenicist, and eugenicism interest in eugenics being comparable to being a Nazi effectively, and so he'll be denigrated on that basis, and so you can quite imagine that the Black Lives Matter people sort of protesting about a statue of Galton that might be somewhere, but the fact of the matter is that he invented meteorology effectively, he invented fingerprinting, and he invented the statistical many methods of statistical analysis. You mentioned regression and correlation that are used in virtually every dissertation. There will be some kind of statistical analysis to prove the theory, the theory behind the dissertation, and the statistical methods that are used to do that and to are a product of Francis Galton's work. And so anybody who's gone to university and got a degree in any subject that requires any kind of numbers to prove the thesis, also anybody that's been burgled and had the police come in and fingerprint the house and found the fingerprints and then been able to find the culprit based on those fingerprints, and those people will have all benefited from the fact that from the work of Francis Galton in developing fingerprinting, and again weather prediction. Anybody who has looks at what the predicted weather is going to be for the day before they decide whether they're going to put their coat on or not when they go out, anybody who does that will also be benefiting from the work of Francis Galton. And so although some of these areas might seem fairly kind of remote and not necessarily the things that would affect everyday people, virtually everybody, as I say, not just in this country but around the world, will have benefited to some extent from the work of Sir Francis Galton.
I guess with the weather, I mean, he must have just recorded the weather each day so that you could then look at it, and then when you saw the same weather coming up, you could predict what was going to come. I mean, just to sort of break it down, obviously he would have been looking at pressure and cyclones and all the rest of it. But this is really important work that he was doing, and none of it's been disproven. I mean, it's politically incorrect now, but nobody's shown that it was wrong. I mean, the whole of the world was following this. America had policies that were in place with this. Germany did. Britain did. America kept up eugenics policies into the 50s. I think there's still accusations of them doing it now, where they try to sterilize, or they pay black people who have drug problems to be sterilized. And, that's part of the negative eugenics that we talked about last week. Positive eugenics, you don't really find that so much now. But the whole of the Western world was engaged in this, in trying to improve the nation. I mean, why wouldn't you do this? None of this has been proved wrong. It's just that it's politically incorrect, and it just gets associated with the Nazis now, so it must be wrong. Well, Galton was interested at first in the question of whether human ability was hereditary, and proposed to count the number of relatives of various degrees of eminent men. If the qualities were hereditary, he reasoned, there should be more eminent men among the relatives than there were among the general population. And to test this, he invented the methods of historiometry, using statistics to analyse references to geniuses, their statements, their behaviour, and their particular discoveries. So they didn't even know that you could inherit intelligence here. They must have had some inkling that musicians passed down through the family, and if there was parents that had musical ability, then the children are likely to have musical ability. But there was no science to actually prove this. And I think this idea of counting the number of eminent men in a family and then taking the average from the population and seeing if there was more, I mean, this is quite a good way of proving it, basically. That it runs in families. And of course today they'll say, oh, it's all because these children go to the posh school and that's why they succeed. No, it's not. The reason why the parents can afford to send them to the posh school is because they married wisely, because they chose their partner wisely, the same as their ancestors chose their partner wisely. And we have this this theory, genetic similarity theory, that Professor J.P. Rushton theorized, which is basically that you pick friends and partners that have this a large amount of the same hereditary genes as you do, which means that you can look at your parents and they will look like you, but you can look at your great grandparents and they will look like you as well. Because right the way along, your ancestors, if they were functioning properly and correctly and hadn't had lots of propaganda to go and race mix, they would have chosen people that looked like them, that had a lot of similar genes. And it means that a similar type of person to you would have been around in all the generations before, because that's who your ancestors would have picked as a partner, which shows you that what you have is hereditary. I mean, we are the sum of all our ancestors, basically. I mean, when you look in the mirror, that's what you're seeing, all your ancestors in your face. Well, he obtained extensive data from a broad range of biographical sources, which he tabulated and then compared in various ways. This pioneering work was described in detail in his book, Hereditary Genius, in 1869, and here he showed, amongst other things, that the numbers of eminent relatives dropped off when going from the first degree to the second degree relatives, and from the second degree to the third, and he took this as evidence for the inheritance of abilities. So that shows that the most bright person, they're going to have bright relatives, they're going to have, say, bright siblings, and the descendants of that very bright person, their children are going to be very bright, but the descendants of his relatives, their children are still going to be bright, but they're not going to be so bright. I guess this might fit in with the firstborn son, because they were always considered to be the most eminent of a family, wasn't it? It was always the firstborn son that was seen as the most important. So I wonder if you found anything out about that, about whether the later offspring, whether they regress to the mean, because we also get this thing called regressing to the mean, which means that you go back to the average. We get these people that are extremely bright, that pop up as a genius, but then their children will gradually revert to the mean, which is basically the average of that people group, which is why you can say, well, the blacks have an IQ of 75 in Africa and 85 in America. And even if you get a black guy with an IQ of 100, gradually his descendants will go back to that mean of either 85 or 75. So I guess he would have discovered that as well. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
Well, I guess that it kind of proves the importance of, you know, when you have a situation where there is uncontrolled immigration, as we have in most Western countries now, and where people are immigrating into Western countries from parts of the world where the average intelligence is lower than it is in the West, it's because some people say, well, you know, you're not affected by immigrants, that's none of your business. Well, the point is that it is some of our business, because if you incorporate within your nation people who come from stock where the average IQ is lower, then you are reducing the mean. And so where there is regression to the mean, the regression is going to go even further down, isn't it?
And that's what we see. You know, we see the average IQ in Britain is gradually going down each year. So on top of these dysgenic policies that, you know, if we didn't change them, we would still have, even if we were a white nation, we would still be going down in IQ. But because we have immigration as well, and the immigration comes from parts of the world where they have a low average IQ, then that brings the average down just by statistics. But by the interbreeding, it's even more harmful. You know, because the people there, you know, are going to have a much lower IQ. And I mean, he was actually the first guy to come out with the phrase nature or nurture and ask that question. But even with nurture, even with the best education, you can only increase an IQ by about 10 points. It can't go up any higher than that. And when you've got races of people whose average is, as I say, is 75. The very, very brightest people among them are going to have an IQ of about 90 or 95. And they're just not going to be able to get it up there into the 120, 130. I mean, amongst the white race, we have people with IQs of 130, 140. You know, these geniuses, which is what he was studying. Because a genius, as you said last week, Max, you know, a genius is worth an infinitesimal amount of money to a nation to have a genius. You look at all these things that he discovered, that he was the guy who created them. And that's just one man, just one polymath. And obviously, you want to have as many of these types of people in your nation as possible, because they will discover so many new things. They will work out so many better ways of doing things, and it will improve the life of everybody in that nation. You do still need the labourer types, but these are the types that you really want. And if you don't have a eugenic society where you encourage the birth of these sorts of people, if you have a society that encourages immigration and rewards the dysgenic types, then you're going to get less and less and less of these geniuses, and life is gradually going to get harder and harder and harder for everyone. I mean, it really is just common sense. It's absolutely crazy the way that we've just ditched all of this and said, oh no, it's politically incorrect, it's bad, the Nazis did it. You know, it's we should have been leading the way with this, and we would have a far more utopian society if we had. There's nothing to stop the other races doing the same, you know, encouraging the breeding of their brightest and their best, rather than encouraging the breeding of those that aren't. I don't know if they engage in eugenics at all in the Arabian countries or in India. Obviously, in India, they have the caste system, and they do still have some very, very bright people over in India, but that also correlates with the fairness of the skin over there. The darker the skin, the lower the IQ, and the lighter the skin, the higher IQ. And the lightest of the skin over there is the highest caste. So obviously, if you have a caste system, you've got eugenics in play there, haven't you? Because you're saying only this type can only marry one of their own type. So the Hindus actually did have a eugenic system in their caste system. Maybe we should have added that to the bit about religion earlier, Max. Do you know much about eugenics in these other countries?
I don't have a great deal of, I don't have any information really of any great extent of the application of eugenics in other countries, other than just to say that, you know, that what you've just been saying is all correct. I think as far as third world countries are concerned, the problem they face from a eugenic perspective nowadays is that the people that tend to migrate and leave those countries to come to the West tend on average to be more intelligent than the ones they leave behind. And so in those third world countries, they should look upon migration as their brain drain. And they used to, that was a term that used to be bandied about quite a lot back in the sort of 60s and 70s, brain drain, because we were all very concerned about our most intelligent scientists being poached and going off to the United States or somewhere else on fatter salaries than we could afford to pay them here. But the effect, the fact of the matter is that as far as third world countries are concerned, they are suffering from a brain drain. And what really needs to be done from in the best interests of those nations is for them to prevent migration and for them to implement eugenic practices in order to increase the intelligence of their general population. That is the key for them in terms of being able to generate a high technology society that will be wealthy. And it's in the interests of all of their people that they should do that. But in reality, what's happening is not only do we have a situation where mass immigration is damaging the Western world, but we have a situation where mass immigration is damaging the third world countries from which the migrants come.
You know, I can remember a school teacher saying something to me, and he would regularly repeat it: quality, not quantity. Quality, not quantity. And it's like we've completely forgotten that. You know, one genius is worth a thousand low IQ people, because that one genius will be capable of advancing those 100 low IQ people far more than they would ever be able to advance themselves, even in 1,000 years. And that's just the way that it is. We seem to have forgotten that it's quality that matters and not quantity. Well, we've gone a little bit over time here, Max, but I think we'll get into some more on Sir Francis Galton next week. So thank you very much for coming on today.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Don't forget, we do require your donations to keep Radio Albion going. And we will be back next week with more Real Britannia for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.